You're listening to Real Estate with Kevin Turner on News Talk 4BC.
Thank you, Danielle. 7 past 7 as we talk real estate, and we do that every Saturday and Sunday morning at this time for Calypso Bay, where you can live your dream lifestyle in Southeast Queensland's premier waterfront development. You can visit them by going to the website calypsobay.com.au and also Water's Edge Apartments. Now, they're on the Redcliffe Peninsula. Absolute waterfront luxury from $875,000. So make it your home. Water's Edge Apartments on the Redcliffe Peninsula. What's coming up in the show today? We are going to talk about affordability. That's a fairly common comment we're hearing all the time. I'll catch up with Danny Addison, who is the Victorian CEO for the Urban Development Institute of Australia, and she has a different view on that. We'll catch up with her a little bit later too. Often wondered, as you probably have too, whether or not this is the best time of year to be selling. Is it all about the time of year? Is it about the price of your property? Is it about where it's located? Well, I'm going to seek the opinion of Charles Tarby, who's the chairman and owner of Century 21, and we'll ask him if it's all a whole bunch of hype about selling at this time of year and what you need to do. And we'll also catch up with the REA, realestate.com.au, chief economist Nerida Connorsby. I'm going to catch up with her in just a little bit about the things that Australians are looking for when they're buying a property, and surprisingly, it isn't at all about the property itself. Now, we've got a few comments to make about the market too. An interesting email I received from a listener just wanting us to maybe try and help demystify the market just a little bit. So we'll certainly do that. We have our last man standing quiz. So we've got a lot to get through in the next hour. So make sure you stay with us. And as I said, a lot to come your way. It's 7:09. My next guest is Danny Addison. Danny is the Victorian Chief Executive Officer of the Urban Development Institute of Australia, and we're talking about affordability. It seems to be something we're talking a lot about. Danny, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you, Kevin?
Good, thank you. Now, in response to Treasurer Scott Morrison's statements this week about combating housing affordability issues, you said that the government needs to have a courageous conversation with the community. What do you mean by that?
That's right. Well, look, I think the most courageous conversation the government does need to have with the community is really the one around density. And we see it time and time again, in particular in Melbourne and in Sydney, in our major capital cities, this real fear of density and the real misunderstanding of what a more dense city would look like and would feel like for the people who already live in it. So it's one that is difficult because there is a lot of community resistance around density, but it's one that is simply inevitable just due to the population growth that we're experiencing, especially here in Melbourne.
To make properties more affordable, we need to make the cities more dense. Do you think we run the risk of overcrowding?
Not if it's done in the right way. And the key to it is really understanding where the spine, how our city works and where the spine of infrastructure and also jobs are located throughout the city, and where those real hubs of activity can be, not just in the central CBD districts, but out in the suburbs and on the peripheral to the city. So planning isn't about looking at a city in terms of what its CBD can offer, but it's about looking at where people move, where the jobs are located, and the transport infrastructure that's needed to support that, and then where is the most appropriate place for the housing that we need to deliver for such a growing population.
Danny, we've seen a lot of research that said that about 50% of Australians will never own a property. I sometimes wonder whether they actually want to, or whether some people, and whether some people are happy to rent for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, I think it's Kevin. I think it's all about choice. I mean, I rent, but I'm also looking to buy my first property at some point in my life. Whether or not I live in that property will be a bit dependent on what kind of property I end up buying. But I think we're starting to think differently about the role property plays in our lives. But it is still a real key part of building wealth and building individual and family wealth in Australia. There's a study that's been done, the Households Income and Labour Dynamic Study in Australia, the HILDA study, and in 2016, they found that the least expensive homes in Australia had experienced a price rise of 108% between 2011 and 2014, which tells us that even the most affordable properties have become far less affordable for the average Australian. So it's about government's got a role to play in advocating that wages keep up, income growth keeps up with the cost of living in this country, but also that there is enough housing and new stock coming into the market to make sure that home ownership is an attainable dream for Australians, as opposed to it just being something that the wealthy few can afford to get into.
Yeah, of course, a lot of blame for unaffordable prices in Australia has been laid squarely at the feet of foreign buyers or foreign investors. Yet to balance that up, there have been reports that we need foreign investment because it's foreign investment who are restricted to buying new properties off the plan that were actually... I think I saw a report the other day that said that for every foreign buyer who buys a unit, it creates another 4 units for local buyers to buy.
That's right. And I believe it's the Property Council of Australia who's done report, which is a very interesting piece of work and a really good one done by them. And it's purely, it comes down to the economics of development as a business and the requirement for many projects or for all projects that that have a component of funding that comes from our big four banks in particular to reach a certain high amount of pre-sales before construction funding is granted. So, you have to essentially pre-sell everything before it can come out of the ground. A lot of the time over recent years, that tipping point between selling enough to get funding to go ahead has been, that little gap there has been met by the overseas investor market. So it has had an impact, the restraint placed on domestic finance from the banks placed on those purchases, on the ability for developers to pre-sell a project and therefore start building.
Yeah. Do you think the attitudes of Australians needs to change when it comes to expectations of owning their own home and even what goes into the home or the size of the home?
Oh, look, I think it will change inevitably whether or not it needs to. I think there'll be so many different views out there that I'd hate to poke that bear. But the reality is that it will change because home ownership is increasingly unattainable and the younger generations are looking at property ownership as a wealth-creating factor but not necessarily as the marker of their of family status that it used to be, owning your home, having your family, all that sort of stuff. I think people are more willing to trade off on location and amenity and other things like that than the backyard. But there is still a huge demand for the Australian dream, and the house and the land packages in Melbourne's greenfields in particular really tell that story about how strong the demand is still for that suburban lifestyle.
Danny, LJ Hooker CEO Grant Harrod has said that abolishing stamp duty would go a long way to increasing affordability for Australians. Would you agree to that?
Yeah, look, I do agree with that, but it isn't a simple solution. A broad-based land tax is definitely a more equitable solution, but it would be a difficult transition for the everyday homeowner to make. What stamp duty does at this point is place a barrier to selling a home or to purchasing a home, and we see this is being particularly important in the downsizer market, and it's a market that we haven't really seen come through yet, but as our baby boomer section of the population gets older and their kids move out and they want to downsize, a big barrier to doing that is often stamp duty and the price it'll cost them to simply sell the family home and purchase a new, different form of dwelling that better suits their needs.
Yeah.
So we find that people stay in their houses a lot longer than maybe they either would or would like to. And this definitely has an impact on the amount of supply that could be available in the inner suburban, or the sort of broader suburban areas for families as opposed to older couples or older single people. So it's a demographic, it's intriguing in a demographic sense, but it's definitely a very active barrier, and it could be addressed by state governments, but state governments rely very heavily on their stamp duty revenue. So I don't anticipate that it will be a quick solution.
What's your view on first homeowners grants? Does it actually fuel the growth in properties, or is that actually a genuine way to help young buyers get in?
Oh, look, I think if I think it is a genuine way to help young buyers get in, especially at that point in their lives. It's often the difference between someone being able to and not being able to buy their first home. And in a market where prices are increasing so rapidly, the sooner people are able to get into the market, it does have a big impact on what that property could be worth to them down the track. So, look, I think it's definitely there's definitely varying views on it from an economic point of view, but it definitely does have a good impact on the first home buyer market as it is, and if and when it's removed, it does have a detrimental impact on the ability of young people to buy into the market.
Danny, great sharing your views. Thank you very much for spending some time with us today.
Good, thank you.
Weekend Real Estate with Kevin Turner. Thanks to Calypso Bay. Live your dream lifestyle in Southeast Queensland's premier waterfront development. CalypsoBay.com.au.
So is spring really a good time to sell? Well, a lot of agents think so. They'll tell you so too. Charles Tarby joins me. Charles is the chairman and owner of Century 21. What do you tell people when they ask you, is this a good time to sell, Charles?
I think there's always a good time to buy and a good time to sell, but you've got to pick the right times to suit your circumstances, Kevin. There's no set standard for a blanket approach to buying or selling real estate. There are some times when you just should sit back and do nothing. And I know that sounds strange coming from a real estate practitioner, but I do think that there are times when you can capitalise on a changing market and sit back and not rush in.
Yeah,
the springtime you mentioned is traditionally the time to sell real estate, but we haven't really had all four seasons of real estate for quite a few years now, because even during winter this year, the year before and the year before that, the market was moving rapidly. Nobody had any concern whether the sun was shining or whether it was raining. People just wanted to buy. And we lost those four seasons. And I still think, when I look at the stock levels that are very low in comparison to this time last year even, that spring has not hit the real estate market to the degree that we needed it to.
Every property sells, though, doesn't it? It just depends on the price and the presentation. You can sell a property in any market, though, can't you?
You absolutely can. There are buyers all the time. They don't just come out during springtime. But I guess when you think about it, try not to have your auctions on football weekends or Melbourne Cup weeks or those sorts of things from a timing perspective. But in the marketplace we're in today, I have no doubt that the seasons still do not matter. I think in some parts of Australia, the undersupply is so noticeable that if properties come up in certain areas, they get sold. Mm. They've got nothing to do with the weather.
Looking at it from a buyer's point of view, they'd be better off buying at a time when there's a lot of stock and not as many buyers.
You can negotiate, and that's the difference. You can negotiate. We look at the clearance rates across the country, all of us do in real estate, and you watch the clearance rates and you think, gee, the market's booming. And I saw at one stage there, I do these clearance rates and stock moving every week for our research, and if you look at the Sydney market just as an example, or the Brisbane market for an example, the clearance rates have increased over this time last year when we thought we were in a boom. They're higher now, but what that doesn't tell you is that not every property goes to auction, and there's a substantial majority, it could be even as high as 85 to 90% that do not go to auction. They're sold by private treaty. So when you're looking at the auction clearance rates, you're often looking at them in areas where the market is strong because of undersupply. And so you can get a false belief that the market is still booming.
Is that why we shouldn't really look too much at the auction clearance rates? They're not all that important?
Yeah, it's important that we, in the areas where auctions occur, yes, you've got to watch it, but in the greater majority of the marketplace, it doesn't exist. And think about it rationally, I guess, if you went into a suburb of Brisbane and there were 10 properties for sale similar that looked similar to each other, why would you go and get a pest report and a building report and a loan approval and pay all the fees to turn up to an auction? Because you can just go down the road and make an offer on something.
Mm.
And this is why I think when there's more properties for sale or of a similar nature in a certain suburb, options are really not a viable way for a seller to go to market.
Century 21, of course, right around Australia. But let's have a look at a moment at the Sydney market, which is still going gangbusters.
Yep.
Affordability. I want to talk to you about that. About the lack of affordability in Sydney compared to, say, a market like Brisbane, as an example. What can we do to make property more affordable?
I think that the marketplaces in Melbourne and the marketplaces in Adelaide, as an example, the state governments got very heavily behind that years ago. They were far more proactive than what we've had, say, in New South Wales and Sydney. And Sydney itself is a little bit landlocked. But the governments in Victoria and in Adelaide worked to release government land. I mean, they even created suburbs that we were involved in Adelaide. It to market entire suburbs. The state government in New South Wales wasn't as proactive in the last few years, and this is what's caused a lot of the undersupply. The development application process in most parts of Australia is not an easy process either, but in Sydney it's even worse. You can go to lodge a development application, or lodge plans for a development application in some councils in Sydney, and at the same time developers are going to Land and Environment Court at exactly the same time because they know they're going to have a problem. Even when, and I saw one development, even a development that met every criteria that council area had laid down, the council still rejected it. And this is part of the problem. And it goes all the way down to local council. The state governments talk about trying to help release more properties, but then they don't work with local councils to drive the agenda there because that's where it starts and that's generally where it stops.
Yeah, because we had that call from the federal treasurer, didn't we, encouraging state governments, local governments to release more land.
And you know what, Kevin, the problem is that most of these issues they start talking about well after the problem has occurred. Because if the markets start to slow down a little and there's a little bit more of residual stock starting to flow through, it might be dangerous for councils to release land. It might be so oversupplied that people who have built asset in their homes and their properties now may actually lose equity. There are definitely strong stories coming out of Perth, as an example, where people can't sell their properties because what they paid for those properties and what their mortgage is today, the mortgage is higher than the value of the asset.
Mm.
And that's the dilemma that a lot of the government bodies could create by talking about releasing land now. They should have been talking about that 3, 4, 5 years ago. Mm. I strongly remember the stats that were coming through many, many years ago that we had an undersupply of almost 200,000 properties. Now, what were they doing about it then? Nothing. And that's been the problem. Now they want to talk about it, but now might be just a bit too late.
Well, we're also looking at lots of reports about an oversupply of units, particularly in Brisbane, also in the Melbourne market, not so much in Sydney. Are you seeing that as well, Charles?
No doubt at all. You see, because living in an apartment is something that people don't mind doing nowadays. I mean, years ago they used to call them home units. Now we call them apartments. It's a lot more stylish, you see. And there's been a push into the cities, but some of the cities don't have the infrastructure or the restaurant scene to support that. And some of the locations where these apartment complexes have gone up are really not as attractive, because you've got to remember that many of the developments that you see around the traps, and I can point you very much into the Sydney market, are where there are old warehouses and factories and freeways and airports, and next thing you know, there are 2,000 apartments built. They're right under the flight path. They're near a busy road, so they're not as appealing as moving, say, straight into the heart of Brisbane City or into the heart of Melbourne or into the heart of Sydney. So this could be a very big issue. RP Data CoreLogic were referencing the fact that there could be 92,000 apartments coming on the marketplace between now and the end of next year.
Those sorts of developments you're talking about there, that's a shortcut to gentrification. I remember some of the suburbs around Australia where they did genuine gentrification. They put the facilities in, then the units
It was the other way around, but now they just seem to think that whack the units in there and we're gentrifying that suburb. It doesn't really work that way.
No, it doesn't. There are suburbs being constructed now in parts of Australia that at least have a master plan, so you can see what the future looks like. But Kevin, one of the things that concerns me about oversupply apartments is the fact that many overseas buyers, and there have been a significant number investing in Australia, not just from Asia, because the UK and the US are our number one and two buyers of real estate in Australia. It's not the Asian market. That comes in at about 5 or 6. But the issue there is that if their economies are struggling in the UK or the US or in Asia, those people that have bought there could easily walk away. Now, they might lose the deposit, but, you know, you're going to struggle. A bank's going to struggle, or a developer's going to struggle trying to sue somebody that's a buyer out of China. I mean, good luck with that. And I think if a lot of those people don't complete on their transactions, there's going to be more than the new stock coming on. There's going to be the stock that people couldn't complete on coming back into the market.
Yeah. Charles, we're out of time, but lovely talking to you, mate. Thank you. Charles Starby, Chairman and owner of Century 21. Thanks, Charles.
Okay, news coming up in just a few seconds. Straight after the news, we're going to have our last man standing quiz. And here's the first question to get you on the phones. 13 13 32, give us a call and Ash will take your call and we'll put you through to the quiz. We've got some great prizes to give away too. The first question I want you to answer and jump on the phone. Located in Scotland, Hogwarts School of Witches and Wizardry is the fictional school attended by which famous wizard? So, located in Scotland, Hogwarts School of Witches and Wizardry is the fictional school attended by which famous wizard? A whole series of movies made out of that one. So, jump on the phone, 13 13 32, and then we've got a series of questions. We're also going to give away some passes to the first BBC British Film Festival, which is being held at the Palace Barracks and Palace Centro Cinema running from now until October 16. This year's BBC First British Film Festival is going to feature a spread of international award-winning films, so don't miss out on that. They're the prizes we've got to give away today. Give us a call if you can answer that question correctly.
You're listening to Real Estate with Kevin Turner on News Talk 4BC.
25 to 8, more news at 8 o'clock. And our last man standing quiz. The question we asked was located in Scotland. Hogwarts School of Witches and Wizardry is the fictional school attended by which famous wizard? I can assume that you got this right, hence you're through to me. Good morning, Susan. How are you?
Oh, very well, thank you.
What's the answer to that question?
Harry Potter.
You are correct. Well done. Okay, let's go to the second one. This one's pretty easy too. Stratford-upon-Avon is the birthplace of which iconic writer? Was it Stephen King, J.K. Rowling, or William Shakespeare?
William Shakespeare.
Oh, yes. Okay, now today is Henry Winkler's 70th birthday. When he played the Fonz on Happy Days, which family were his downstairs neighbours? Can you remember that?
Yes, the Cunningham.
Oh, yeah, you're good. Okay, let's go to the next one. Elm Street is the setting of Wes Craven's 1980s horror movie franchise Nightmare on Elm Street. What was the name of the scar-faced villain from the movies?
Oh, I don't know. I didn't watch those ones.
Oh, didn't you?
Sorry about that.
No. That's okay. So I'll tell you what we're going to do. I'll give you back to Ash, and we're going to give you a prize anyway, because you've done really well. We'll give you a double pass to get along to see the first British Film Festival. Would you like that?
Lovely, yes.
You hang on, Susan, and I'll put you back to Ash, and we'll make sure that happens. Anne, let's move to you. Good morning, Anne. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Good. Do you know the answer to that question? You want me to repeat it?
No, I don't know the answer, sorry.
Oh, come on. Hey, it's not, don't
I
you...
I didn't watch it either.
What, Elm Street, the Nightmare... No, actually, you know what? I don't think I did either. I'll give you a hint, all right? His first name was Freddy.
No, sorry.
You don't know?
No.
Okay. Well, so I tell you what, we'll go to the last. We'll go to the last question. See if you can get that one. I'm sure you can get this one. Ramsay Street is the name of a location from which Australian TV show? Do you know that one?
Neighbours.
You are right. Okay, I've got a prize for you too, because I reckon everyone on Sunday morning should win a prize. So we're going to give you a double pass to get along and see that first British Film Festival as well. Okay.
Oh, lovely! Thank you so much.
And listen, the answer to that last one was Freddy Krueger.
Oh, okay.
You remember it now?
Yeah, I will now.
Hey, Anne, you enjoy the movies, okay?
Yeah, I will. Thank you.
Good on you. Hey, I'll put you back. Stay there. I'll put you back to Ash and we'll organise that prize for you. Yeah, we like everyone to be a winner. I actually got an email in from Sarah who said, Kevin, I'm really confused by lots of reports in the media. I'm looking to invest in property. Can you give me a brief overview of what's really happening with the market? Look, I do understand, Sarah, it's actually a very confusing situation. Let me just try and clarify it a little bit for you. Across all the individual capital cities in Australia, the annual change in home values has been recorded at, in Sydney, 10.2%, Melbourne up 9%, Brisbane up 3%, Adelaide up 6.5%, Perth came back by 7%, and in Hobart, there was an increase of 8.7%. Generally across Australia, Sarah, houses have definitely outperformed apartments. And I want to touch on apartments just for a minute because there's been a lot of concern and discussion about an oversupply. To give you a bit of an idea about why people are so concerned about this, currently under construction. Now, this is not approved. These are units that are currently under construction across Australia, 150,000 units under construction. In a typical market, we see about 35,000 units. So you can see there is a dramatic number of units currently under construction. Now, settlement of these is going to take place within the next 18 to 24 months. According to CoreLogic, 42.3% of off-the-plan Brisbane apartments are coming in at valuations below the contract price. Now, this adds a whole new dimension to, you know, we've got an oversupply, but whether or not the banks will actually be willing to or able to fund a lot of the purchases coming through. So there's a possibility there could be a lot of default purchases. The banks are restricting lending. Locations that are performing strongly are the real winners. So what it says, Sarah, is that strict property selection is going to be the critical to obtaining capital growth over the next few years. The other thing that compounds the problem for property is employment. Property price growth is going to be driven by economic growth. That's going to lead to wages growth, which will encourage population growth and the need for more housing. Now, it's predicted that in the next 5 years, 80% of all the jobs created will be in the capital cities of Brisbane, Sydney and Melbourne, Adelaide and Perth, of course. But let's look at the three major East Coast ones. 35% of all new jobs created are going to be in New South Wales, 30% in Victoria, and that means more than two-thirds of the new jobs created are going to be in those two capital cities. That's why I believe that those locations are going to continue to perform really strongly because it is on the back of employment. And we talked to Dr. Andrew Wilson about this only yesterday. In Queensland, by contrast, only 15% of the jobs created are going to be in this state. So most people will want to live close to these economic generators. There's no question of that, and we've seen that happen in the past. So I see the three major capital cities outperforming regional areas. Now, I want to take that a little bit deeper for you. Let's have a look at Brisbane. Now, Brisbane's had the same interest rates as the other capital cities, obviously. It's considered to be much more affordable. We're hearing that all the time too, to get a property in Brisbane. Much more affordable, yet Southeast Queensland property in general hasn't created enough jobs, so therefore it hasn't really kept pace. Residential vacancies in Brisbane, in the middle, this is the key thing, and this is the message I'd like to get across to you, Sarah, if you're really interested in investing in Brisbane. Residential vacancies in Brisbane in the middle ring suburbs almost doubled in the 3 months to September, as the growing number of inner-city apartments sucked in tenants with competitive rental rates. So we're seeing a lot of tenants moving towards the city, which is where there have been a lot of incentives. Suburbs like Kedron, Lutwyche and Corinda, where there's been a lot of supply happening within the band 5 kilometres to 20 kilometres from the centre of the city, they're the ones that have suffered most. Their vacancies there, according to the REIQ, have jumped to 4.5% from 2.3% in June. So this has been quite alarming. Now, having said all that, interest rates also are a key thing that we're watching, and a number of pundits tipping that interest rates may just drop again on Tuesday. But I really don't think that one or two interest rate rises are going to spook the market and lower consumer confidence and business confidence, which is going to impact on the property market. First home buyers tend to be more interest rate sensitive, meaning that properties in the outer, newer suburbs and the blue collar areas are likely to suffer. Prestige end of the market and the holiday locations, say of the Gold Coast and the Sunshine Coast, are likely to suffer as discretionary spending decreases. Bottom line, definitely start looking at the middle ring suburbs of Brisbane. These are the ones that are probably going to perform the best, and you're looking at prices anywhere from $500,000 to $600,000. So, Sarah, I hope that gives you a bit of an overview on what the market's looking like, what it's going to be doing, and so on. Currently, it's 8:16 4BC. We're talking real estate.
You're listening to Real Estate with Kevin Turner on News Talk 4BC.
I'm joined now by Nerida Connersby, who is from the REA Group, Chief Economist, of course, with realestate.com.au. Nerida, thanks again for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me about the Group Property Demand Index. What's that about?
So what we've been doing is tracking demand for property in the Australian market since about 2013. And basically how we track it, we look at the number of people looking to buy property and contrast that to the supply of property. So we're starting to get some really interesting results. And probably the most interesting is that Sydney and Melbourne are now at record levels in terms of demand.
Demand. Okay. Well, that, of course, begs me to ask the question about supply and demand. And there's a lot of talk about an oversupply or a lack of demand for some of the inner city areas around Brisbane, as an example. Does the index show that?
Look, it doesn't. It was interesting. Like, Queensland sits about on average for apartment, sits about the Australian average for apartment demand and also for housing demand. I think, though, what's happening is that although Queensland is sitting in that position, it's really places like the Gold Coast, Sunshine Coast, that are really propping up that apartment demand. I think, you know, most people would be pretty nervous at the moment with Brisbane CBD, and you know, I think though the strength of other markets is really offsetting that.
Nerida, what was the number one most in-demand suburb around Australia?
The number one most in-demand suburb was a suburb called Warrandyte in the northeast of Melbourne. So it was an outer suburban area, a pretty leafy area. It's an area that has a fairly large diversity of homes, from fairly low-cost homes to high-cost sort of luxury homes. So that was the number one for housing. For apartments, it was Manly. So Manly in Sydney, beachside, very popular, not just with people from Australia, but also globally as well.
Mm. I see that the South Australian market made the top 10 list. Did that surprise you?
Look, it did surprise me. I mean, South Australia sits kind of between, on average, kind of between Queensland and WA. So it's not a high demand market, but certainly there was a suburb. The suburb of Norwood came in the top 10 for houses. So yeah, I think the fact that, you know, Adelaide is pretty affordable from a national perspective was part of it. But also that's a really great suburb in Adelaide as well. So I think, you know, you'd have a lot of local people wanting to buy there as well.
Yeah, fair enough. You mentioned earlier about Sydney and Melbourne and how they're still high in demand. Do you see them remaining hot for some time to come?
Well, look, the index certainly shows that they will remain hot. I think, you know, we've seen this sort of rapid increase in interest. I mean, what was interesting though was apartment demand in Melbourne was kind of on the average, kind of on the Australian average. So, you know, the fact that there's been so many apartments built in Melbourne is really moderating those demand levels. So, but if we look at houses, we're seeing a very different situation.
There's a report out that we'll be talking about in the show too, that from one particular commentator who says that unit prices around Australia are going to drop by anything up to 15 to 20% over the next couple of years. What's your take on that?
Look, I think it's simplistic to look at the apartment market in Australia as one market. And, you know, if we have a look at places like Brisbane CBD or Melbourne CBD, I think there is a perception, or you know, the reality is that we're seeing a large amount of development, and it's quite possible we will see a drop in prices. If we look at Sydney, though, Sydney is still seeing very high demand for apartments. We're seeing relatively little development from a national perspective, also an historical perspective. And so I think the situation in Sydney will be quite different. So I think, you know, overall, I'd be surprised if we saw as high a drop nationally of 15% in apartments. But I do think perhaps we may see some apartment types in some locations dropping.
Nerida Connorsby is my guest, Chief Economist at the REA Group. So let's move to affordability just for a moment, because I'm keen to know from you whether affordability is the big driver. What makes properties popular?
Yeah, look, affordability does seem to be a big driver at the moment. We have a look at suburbs that are moving up in popularity. They do seem to be those that are more affordable. So particularly Tasmania featured quite strongly in those suburbs. The places like Belrive, Hobart move quite quickly up our list of popularity. So affordability is a huge driver. Not so much in Sydney. So Sydney's a little bit different at the moment. The suburbs that are getting more popular aren't necessarily affordable. But, you know, we are seeing a bit of a movement to the central coast in Sydney because of how expensive Sydney is.
Yeah. How much of this is driven by monetary policy? Is that actually what's distorting the market, or you know, rate cuts leading to an acceleration in prices? Is this what's making the problem of affordability even worse?
Yeah, look, definitely. I mean, yeah. I think if you look at what is happening with monetary policy, the Reserve Bank felt comfortable cutting rates, the two rate cuts that we saw this year, because they thought prices were moderating. And looking at that time, data suggested that prices were moderating. So they made the two cuts. But certainly when we have a look at our index, demand really surged following those two cuts. So our index surged in terms of demand, but we also saw quite strong price growth, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne. So that they do. It's a really difficult one because, you know, historically we have been reliant on monetary policy to drive the economy, but at the moment it does seem to be messing around with the housing market.
Yeah, jobs too are a big driver, aren't they, where people can live. I know affordability is important. If affordability is that important, are we seeing a loss of people out of Sydney because it is so unaffordable?
Yeah, look, we are. So Sydney does attract the most overseas migrants in Australia, but has been losing quite a lot of people over the past decade. And part of that would have been jobs during the mining boom. So Sydney would have lost quite a few people to WA and Queensland as a result of that. But certainly at the moment, they're still losing people. And I think affordability has a lot to do with that. Mm. So, you know, the fact that Sydney is so unaffordable is going to be a brake on economic growth for that state. So if people, you know, if you can't get the right sort of people, if you can't get a diversity of different types of people living in your city, then it does really lead to problems with economic growth.
Yeah, Bernard Salt, of course, wrote an article a couple of weekends ago, and we spoke to him in the show last week about avocado, the cost of avocado on toast. Is it that simple?
Look, no, it's not. I mean, if you have a look at the rate of growth in house prices, particularly in places like Sydney and Melbourne, you know, cutting a few breakfasts isn't going to cut it in terms of keeping up with price growth. So, you know, I think there's, you know, if you have a look at the ratio of household income to prices, if you look at that, how that's changed, particularly since the time when perhaps, you know, baby boomers are in the market, that ratio has really, really increased. And, you know, Sydney is the second most unaffordable city in the world after Hong Kong. And unlike Hong Kong, though, we don't have a huge social housing backup that Hong Kong has. So, yeah, I mean, it's quite simplistic to say, you know, if younger people just stopped spending money on fun stuff, they'd be able to afford a home, when the reality is, no, they wouldn't be able to do. It's not that simple. But the other thing too, I think, is that people will have to become more used to living in higher densities. So yeah. I think that is definitely the case. That as our cities grow, as more people want to live in inner areas, we do have to get used to living in higher density apartments or housing.
Land supply, of course, a big problem. We saw the Federal Treasurer come out and encourage state governments and local councils to release more land. Would that help?
Yeah, look, it would help. You know, there's lots of things that government can do. I think, you know, things like streamlining the planning process, making it easier for developers to, you know, do what they do best is a key factor.
Yeah.
Releasing land, you know, there's lots of things local government can do. And I think one of the things being done in Sydney at the moment is the amalgamation of councils. And, you know, that is a key thing, that if you can get bigger councils, they've got, you know, better they can start to put in better planning procedures and make it far more streamlined. So, you know, changes to planning, release of land, better infrastructure, all these things lead to greater affordability.
Mm. Nerida, great talking to you. Nerida Connorsby, Chief Economist at the REA Group. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
Weekend Real Estate with Kevin Turner. Thanks to Calypso Bay. Live your dream lifestyle in Southeast Queensland's premier waterfront development. CalypsoBay.com.au.
And we're only about a minute and a half away from news. Yesterday in the show, Joel... I was actually... We were talking about smoke alarms and smoke alarm solutions. And... we had a number of calls overnight about what the legislation's all about. We're going to get more information for you next week in the show, but the bottom line is that when you're replacing smoke alarms from January of next year, they're going to have to be photoelectric type. Now, they'll all have to be photoelectric by 2027, but it starts to click in from January next year. They've got to be less than 10 years. They've all got to be interconnected. And the bottom line is that most rental properties we'll have to move from one or two alarm systems to anything up to four or six, and they're going to be about $400 each. So the recommendation is that you should be replacing or actually installing one each year, which is going to cut back on your capital costs. So if you're looking at replacing a new alarm and putting them in, but as I said, most rental properties are going to be having to carry anywhere between four and six. We'll get more information on that for you next week. Joel Helms will join us and we'll talk about that. It's coming up to 8 o'clock news. I'll see you again next Saturday and Sunday between 7 and 8. See you then.